Welcome. Good morning. You know, in the past several weeks, Quinn has led us through the early chapters of Genesis. We started where we ought to. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And last week, we concluded with the account of Babel. I want to pick up there with the next major character that we see in Genesis, which is Abram. And you'll probably hear me call him Abram or Abraham as we go along. It's all the same guy, so don't think I'm confused, though I might be on some other things. I'm going to focus this morning on chapter 15. The title of this chapter in many of our translations is centered around the Abrahamic covenant. And I'm going to look at that covenant itself, but I want to focus more this morning on the relationship that God has with Abram. So let's look first at the events. I'm going to lead you through the events of Abram's life leading up to this point. If you were to go back to chapter 12, the first thing we hear is that God calls Abram out of Ur of the Chaldeans. He calls him at age 75. Abram takes his wife Sarai, and he takes his nephew Lot, and he leaves, and he heads for Canaan. A famine overtakes Canaan, so Abram takes Sarai to Egypt, where he lies to Pharaoh about her being his sister. And back in Canaan, God prospers Abram and Lot to the point that they can't even live together peaceably. God has just poured so much blessing on these two that they can't even figure out how to get along in the same space. So Abram tells Lot, he says, pick any piece of land you want in all of Canaan, and it's yours. And Lot, being the awesome human being that he is, takes the very best and leaves Abram out in the desert, practically. In chapter 14, we see a battle of kings. One team of kings emerges victorious, as we might expect, and on their victory tour, they loot and pillage the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah. And when they do that, they enslave Abram's nephew Lot in the process. So Abram hears word of this and takes 318 of his trained men, and he goes and he routs this previous victorious set of kings, and he rescues his nephew. Then we see an encounter between Abram and the king priest, Melchizedek, in which Abram is affirmed as blessed by God. By the end of chapter 14, we see Abram standing on the mountaintop of life. I wonder what often happens immediately after we get to the mountaintops in our lives. We recognize that there is precious little room on the top of this mountain, and we start to peer out and see what's in front of us in the valleys of life that are below us there. We have similar mountaintop moments in our own lives. After we've purchased our home that we've scrimped and we've saved so long for, we recognize how much we want to change and how much things there are to fix. We get that promotion that we put so many hours into, and we come to this crossroads of great expectations and great responsibility, and we start to feel the weight of these other expectations that are now before us. And when we hold that newborn child that we've prayed so long for, we go through the sleepless nights and all the changing of the diapers, and we realize what obligations now lay before us. Now, you guys couldn't hear it, but my wife at that very moment says, what does he know about sleepless nights and diapers? And she's right, I don't, but the illustration holds its own value. And this is where we find Abram. Having found one of his mountaintops of life, Abram is having a moment of introspection. Having succeeded over an army of kings and receiving blessing from a great king priest, Abram sits back and takes a deep breath. He kicks back in his chair, and he looks at the wall, and he loses focus, and he just thinks about everything that God has brought him through from the time of Ur until now. And he reflects on the promises that God has made to him along the way. And so we start our text this morning. We're gonna be in Genesis 15, studying verses 1 to 10, finishing with 17 and 18. And this morning, I'm in the interest of time, I'm going to try and get you guys out here on time. We're going to read the scripture as we progress through it rather than the whole passage at once. So start with me here as we ought to start in verse 1. We read in 15:1, after these events, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward will be very great. We see God first. He says, do not be afraid. After Abram's victory over an army of kings, after he gets blessed by this great king priest of Melchizedek, does this strike you as odd? I mean, what does Abram have to be afraid of? He's just done whooped the set of five kings that already thumped on the set of four kings, and he's got this great blessing from the king priest of Jerusalem. I wonder what he could possibly be afraid of. Abram is afraid that after hearing the promises of God for a son three different times up until this point, that he's getting along in years, And he's having doubts that these promises of God will be fulfilled. Next, God says, your reward will be very great. And in doing, he gives him a general affirmation that the blessings that he promised him will be worth waiting for. And then God finally, he tells him, I'm your shield. Abram, do not fear the passage of time from when I first made these promises to you until now. I will protect you from this fear of yours, and I will fulfill my promises. Now, we said it's earlier that it was curious that God tells Abram, do not be afraid. And at this point, I think we should ask ourselves a question. How does God know that Abraham's afraid? Obviously, the Sunday school answer that God knows everything is correct, and it is here. But I want to talk more about just the omniscience of God, the all-knowingness of God. I want to focus on something a little deeper that we might not see in our casual readings. I like to do audience participation, and I'm going to do it again this morning. If you would, please, if you've been married for 40 years, would you raise your hands, please? If you've been married for 50 years, would you keep your hands up? Awesome, right? There are saints on the other side of these people that have been married for 50 years, right? Has there ever been a time in those years of marriage where you've recognized what your spouse was thinking just by the look on their face? Maybe your wife was pregnant, and in having breakfast with her, you notice this sleepy little smile as she stares at the wall, and you can recognize that in her mind, she's just picked out a name of the child that is about to be born. Or driving down the interstate with your husband, a song comes on the radio, and you recognize this song. And every time this song used to come on, your husband would relate the same story about his father that this reminds him of. The same father that passed away recently. And you look at your husband, and he loses focus into the dashboard, and you see the muscles of his jaw tense up. You know what he's thinking. More than likely, these two examples, as I've laid them out here, have not happened exactly in your life. But I am absolutely certain that those of you who have been married for 50-plus years, you have some stories you could tell us that reflect this same point I'm trying to illustrate. God knows that Abraham is afraid because Abraham has an intimate relationship with God that goes far beyond any of the all-knowing that God can see and know. Abraham does not see God as a distant being who created the world like he was spinning a top, and then he just steps back and watches it spin. God does not relate to Abraham in a way that Abraham just sits back and waits for these lightning bolts to come down into his life as he breaks these rules. Abraham has a depth of relationship with God that we see here. And it's important for a clear understanding of our study this morning that we identify this old married couple kind of depth of relationship that God and Abraham have together. Now, after hearing God's encouragement in verse 1, Abram addresses God and begins a very open and honest discussion about where Abram's heart is at. Read with me in verses 2 and 3. But Abram said, Lord God, what can you give me, since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Abram continued, look, you have given me no offspring, so a slave born in my house will be my heir. Now, before we started, God had promised Abram a son three times. Abram has just heard a fourth promise of a son from God. And Abram is now frustrated to the point that he questions even the willingness of God himself that he's actually going to fulfill these things he's talking about. As I read this, I hear Abram's voice. He says, Lord, I have traveled from Ur to Haran, to Egypt, and back to Canaan. I have taken care of my brother's son, giving him the first choice that Canaan has to offer. Then I risked my life and the lives of my people to go save him from this band of kings. I still have no son of my own. And since it's becoming obvious to me that I never will, what will you give me? I don't know if you can feel the force of Abram's frustration here. Certainly, in the story of your life, you've had similar conversations, right? With your parents, probably at one point or another, with your spouse, and those with your kids. This frustration builds and it builds and it builds until it explodes out of you, right? This is what we see in this conversation Abram has with God. And we tend to have these conversations with people for whom we have special expectations. Expectations of a loving, mutual relationship, right? You tend to my needs and I'll tend to yours. You keep your promises to me and I'll keep my promises to you. Now, we may get angry with those people that we have shallower relationships with. We get angry when the amount of effort we invest in people goes unnoticed, or the effort we put into projects goes unnoticed. Now, this level of frustration that Abraham shows is reserved for those that are closest to us, those that we consider our family. This is the relationship that we see between Abram and God. God and Abraham are as intimate as family members. And observing the depth of a relationship between God and Abram, we've witnessed this impassioned plea concerning the unfulfilled promises Abram's struggling to wait on. So how does God respond? Let's look at verses 4 and 5. Now the word of the Lord came to him. This one will not be your heir. Instead, one who comes from your own body will be your heir. He took him outside and said, look at the sky and count the stars if you are able to count them. Then he said to him, your offspring will be that numerous. I want to notice two things that show us God's character here. First is God's consistency. This is the exact same message that God has been given to Abram since he pulled him out of Ur, okay? If we look in verses 12:2, and I'll just read them quickly for you. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you, God tells Abram. In 12:7, he says, I will give this land to your offspring, Abram. And in 13:15, he says, for I will give you and your offspring forever all the land that you see. God's promise is consistent, and it has been from the get-go. I hope you'll be encouraged this morning that the God that was consistent with Abram thousands of years ago is consistent with you and me today. When we receive God's calling, it almost always entails some level of waiting, right? You all have experienced that. Abram waited for 25 years for Isaac to be born from the time God originally promised it to him. But God was faithful, and he fulfilled his plan to the greatest of his glory. Be confident this morning that when God leads you, he'll see you through in his timing, which though we might not think it so, it's always better than our timing. Be confident of that this morning. If the first component of God's character is consistency, the second is grace, and we're going to see this a bunch today. I don't know how you guys feel when you read this, but I kind of get offended on God's behalf a little bit. I kind of bow up when I hear Abraham getting as frustrated with God as he does. And I kind of get this, who do you think you are speech kind of going up inside me as I look for God to address Abram. I've told you now, Abram, at least three times that I was going to give you your own offspring and your place to build a nation. Have I not? All of these flocks, herds, tents, gold, silver, where do you think they came from? From your hand? I've always taken care of you. I don't want to hear your what will you give me. I'll give you something to cry about. That's what I'll give you. But that's not the God that we see. We don't see that. The God we see puts his arm around Abram, and he walks him out the door, and he shows him the stars. God affirms not only the truth of his promise, but the magnitude of his promise. The God we see does not treat Abram as we might treat each other, with a pride that bristles at being questioned. God returns compassion for Abram's frustration. God gives him grace. And if we will accept it, God has grace for you and I today as we struggle to wait on God's promises to us. Now, undoubtedly, looking at the stars alongside the one who made them has to evoke some sort of response. So let's see how Abraham is moved as we read verse 6. We read, Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Now, Abram's response, we see in the first part of this verse, he believed. This is ordinary, in my opinion, and this is expected. Abram believed. Why should he not? God rescued Abram from Pharaoh. God took care of Abram as he battled these marauding kings. God encourages Abram through the great priest Melchizedek, and he speaks to Abram personally. Has Abram any lack of reasons to believe God? Have you today? Abram counts the stars with God and gains confidence in the promises that God has made to him. So if Abram did what he should have done and believed, God does something here that no one could expect. We read in the last statement, we see what God has done, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Now, if we read this in a casual manner, we will completely miss the immense amount of what God has to tell us in this one verse, and there is a lot, I promise. Let's investigate a bit. I want to start with the word righteousness. It's a church word we use a lot, right? And we generally know that righteousness is good stuff, right? If you're righteous, you're good. Noah Webster's 1828 dictionary defines righteousness. It's purity of heart and rectitude of life, conformity of heart and life to the divine law. It includes all we call justice, honesty, and virtue. So let's boil that down to conformance to God's standard. Righteousness is a conformance to God's standard. So we can understand the meaning of the word now as we've laid it out, but how are we to understand that that applies to Abram? We've just talked about him. We talked earlier about the poor showing he makes as a husband in Egypt with Pharaoh, where he puts Sarai in danger. In the next chapter, in chapter 16, Abram takes his wife's maidservant, Hagar, and does something completely contrary to God's will. And then in verse 20, Abram pulls the same Sarai as my sister's stunt with Abimelech, the king of Gerar. So if we're calling righteousness conformance to God's standard, how do we reconcile Abram's conduct with this definition we've made of righteousness? How is it possible? Well, the reason that it's possible is that Abram's righteousness has absolutely nothing to do with his conduct. Nothing. Abram's conformance to God's standard has absolutely nothing to do with his ability to walk the straight and narrow. The effect is Abram's righteousness. The cause is Abram believed the Lord. That's the cause of the righteousness. It is caused by Abram's exercise of faith here. If you've ever wondered how folks in the Old Testament experienced atonement for their sins prior to Jesus' resurrection, you're looking at it. It's not by keeping the commandments. Abram's walking around before Moses even got the tablets with the commandments written on them. Abram and everyone else in the Old Testament is saved through a personal relationship with God. This is exactly the same way that you and I are saved today. Abram seeks a relationship with God, and he finds it. No big deal there. Nothing unexpected. No surprise. In return for a relationship with Abram, God offers him an abundance in this life and the hope of eternity in paradise with him in the next. I hope that blows you away this morning. This is the understatement I'm talking about in this verse. That is amazing. Think about the deepest, most intimate relationship you have on this planet. Now imagine that in order for you to maintain that relationship, you have to give up everything you own. Not only everything that you own, but everything that you're going to own from now until the day you die. Not only that, but everything that your children are going to get, everything their grandchildren, great-grandchildren, onto eternity, everything that they're going to obtain, their wealth and possessions, you're going to have to give to this other person with whom you have this deepest relationship, okay? Now, as awesome as that relationship is that you have, I think we are going to struggle today if that's the price to maintain that relationship, right? Are we not? But God, he essentially jumps at that offer. And in dealing with God in illustrations, they're always imperfect, so we can't imagine what it would look like if God traded away all his possessions. But in return for our relationship, God gives us mercy for our failures. He gives us grace for our sin. He gives us security and hope for a future and the great comfort of his love. He gives us the clothing and the food and the shelter that our physical frames need until those physical frames wear out. And then what? He takes us home to heaven, where the eye has not seen, ear has not heard, and it has never entered into the heart of man all the things which God has prepared for those who love him. Wow, right? That is a sweet, sweet deal for us. I hope you guys see that. The Powerball lottery, as I understand it, was up to $600 million yesterday. And if you buy a winning lottery ticket, the simple act of buying that lottery ticket is going to get you $600 million, right? That is a pretty fair deal if you can buy that ticket, right? God's offer is a guaranteed lottery ticket. And I promise you, the $600 million, as awesome as that might be, won't hold a candle to everything that God has for you and for me. Best trade ever, okay? I hope you guys can see that. This is the character of our God. This is how much he desires a relationship with us. The crediting of righteousness to Abraham was a fantastic news in that day. And the crediting of righteousness to us is fantastic news today. Now at this point, we've seen God extend compassion to Abram and Abraham's frustration with waiting on God's timing. And then we've witnessed the tidal wave of blessing that God returned engulfs Abraham in response to this simple act of faithfulness, right? And there is one more display of God's grace that we're going to look at this morning. We read of a concrete commitment that God makes, and he starts in verse 7. He also said to him, I am Yahweh, who brought you from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. Now, this section strikes me as kind of funny. It feels to me like God is prepping Abraham for the statement he's about to make to him, because he's dealt with Abraham and he knows how he is. God says, I am Yahweh, remember, okay, we know who we're talking to, who brought you from Ur. Remember all the things I've been with you through from thence time until now. And then he gives him the promise. He says, to give you this land to possess. God is, again, consistent in his promise here. This is the same thing he's told Abram since chapter 12. And then we look at Abraham, and he starts off his reply with but, which is not all that encouraging. But then he goes on and he says, Lord God, and I kind of feel myself raising my hands a little bit, like I'm about to celebrate with Abraham that he finally gets it. He's going to turn the corner and he's going to be so impacted by God's love that he's going to take this promise that God just made to him and he's going to run with it, right? Abram says in verse 8, he says, but he said, Lord God, how can I know that I will possess it? What? Are you serious? Have you not? We've just been through time and time and time again how God has seen you through all of these things, right? I don't know if you guys watch ESPN on Sunday nights, but there's a segment there where they go through all the follies in the week of sports, right? And at the end, all of the guys in the studio at the same time, they give you this, come on, man. That's exactly what I feel like is here when we look at what Abram's doing in response to the promises that God's giving him. The Lord that made the stars puts his arm around you. He walks with you outside. He speaks to you about them. And then God reveals to Abraham the most spectacular fireworks display of blessing that has ever been created in the history of the world. And all Abraham does is light the fuse. How in the world can Abraham ask this question? How can I know that I will possess it? How can you ask that? I'm so glad that I'm not God, and if my kids were here, they'd amen to that. Because at this point, I think I would just lose it on Abraham. What do you mean, how? I'm God. I brought you from Ur all the way here. I saved your knucklehead from Pharaoh when you pulled that stunt with your sister, Sarai. And those five kings would have whooped your tail if I had not been right next to you, fighting alongside you. How can you ask me how? But, again, that's not the response we see from this great and wonderful God that we serve. God doesn't miss a beat. He's about to overwhelm Abraham one more time. If we look in verses 9 and 10, God says to him, bring me a 3-year-old cow, a 3-year-old female goat, a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. So he brought all these to him, split them down the middle, and laid the pieces opposite each other. But he did not cut up the birds. And then skipping down to 17, when the sun had set and it was dark, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch appeared and passed between the divided animals. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, I give this land to your offspring from the brook of Egypt to the Euphrates River. God tells Abraham to round up this specific set of animals, and Abraham is faithful and he does that. And he splits them in half and lays them on opposite sides, forming an aisle of sorts in between them all. And then we see a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch in the dark that then passes between those animals. Then God again promises the same land to Abram that he's been promising him for many, many years now. And he defines the boundaries from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. Now this is a basic covenant ceremony in Old Testament times. If you read back through the scriptures, you will see other examples of this cut the animals in half and pass through them example. We have an oath. God promises Abraham and his descendants the land of his possession. We then see the slaughter of an animal as a sacrifice when Abram gathers the animals and cuts them in half and arranges them. And then we see the passing between the halves of the animals. Now, this signifies the binding nature of this agreement. Now, to some of you, this might seem pretty gruesome, I can see some faces of some people in here that aren't terribly thrilled with this idea. And to others, it sounds a little bit like last weekend when you filled your elk tag. Be certain that the binding nature of cutting a covenant with another in the Old Testament is a big deal. And again, you can read the consequences of breaking this covenant are severe. Now, in this covenant ceremony, each party that passes through the animal halves is bound by the covenant, by the oath, and by the terms. Notice in verse 17, who's not passing through the animal halves? It's Abram. Abram's not passing through. But what is passing through? A smoking fire pot and a flaming torch. We need to understand these as fiery representations of God himself that passes through the animal halves. So we have a covenant that God is making with Abram. God binds himself to the terms of this covenant without any requirement from Abraham. Abram sees God himself, a figure, a fiery representation of God, pass through these animal halves. If this doesn't convince God of his concrete commitment to bless Abraham with the blessings he's been telling him of, what is? Again, we are witness to a waterfall of grace which God showers upon Abraham. Abram displays the inconsistency of his belief. And in this roller coaster thing that we call life, I know that we can all identify with that. How does God deal with Abram's inconsistency? He gives him grace. He gives him grace upon grace. By entering into this one-sided covenant with Abraham, by further cementing this relationship that he has with him. Now, God's covenant is unique. I don't know of anybody that I've talked to in the past week that was telling me about Tuesday when they cut the animals in half and then they walked between them so that they could shake hands with the guy and sell a car. You know, I don't see that. So God's covenant in this respect is unique, but God's covenant making with his people is not. God makes a covenant with no one. He seals it with a rainbow. God makes a covenant with you and I today. In the beginning, man walked with God in a garden of paradise. But when the black river of sin entered into that world, it cut a canyon between God and us. Man stands by himself on the crest of this canyon in a sin-corrupted world with no refuge in it and no hope to cross that canyon. The only bridge that exists is Jesus Christ, built when Jesus died on that cross and resurrected again that Easter Sunday. This is a two-sided covenant we have with God. God has already fulfilled his part. He built the bridge through his son, Jesus. Our part in the covenant is simply to believe in God, to exercise our faith that Jesus himself is, in fact, the bridge that we need to enter into a relationship with the God that loved us enough to build a bridge.